We'll hear arguments next in 76-911, Adamo Wrecking Company against the United States. Mr. Lipnick, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This is a criminal case arising under the Clean Air Act as it stood prior to the amendment of this past summer. Section 112B of the Act, as it then stood, instructed the administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency to promulgate an emission standard to control emissions of hazardous air pollutants, one of which is asbestos. The administrator issued a work practice regulation for demolition operations and gave it the title emission standard. Section 112C of the Act prohibits a violation of an emission standard. My client is accused by an indictment of violating Section 112C of the Act for an alleged failure to follow the Environmental Protection Agency's work practice rule. In the trial court, we challenged the indictment on the ground that a violation of an emission standard is an essential element of the crime and that a work practice rule is not the same thing as an emission standard, notwithstanding its title. The trial court agreed and dismissed the first count of a two-count indictment, which is the only count now before this court. The government appealed and the Sixth Circuit reversed. The Sixth Circuit held that our position amounted to a challenge to the validity of the regulation itself.
May I ask, what is left of the case after the amendments?
I'm sorry, sir?
What is left of your issue after the amendments this summer?
Clarify. Well, one thing that's left is whether my client has to go to trial and possibly be convicted of a felony.
I know. The issue is the meaning of that statute, isn't it?
The first issue, as I understand it, sir, is the meaning of Section 307B2 of the Act, which by its language says there shall be no judicial review in a civil or criminal proceeding for enforcement of action which could have been reviewed under the statutory review procedure. I think one issue which is still open for decision by this court is whether that statute, that preclusion provision, is in fact an absolute preclusion of all judicial consideration of the propriety of actions by the administrator, even actions which on their face are alleged to be in violation of his duties under the Act.
Well, if it is an absolute preclusion, do you make any claim in this case, or have you, that kind of a preclusion, purported conclusion, would be unconstitutional?
I think that's a question of fact which would have to be developed at trial, sir. I think it would depend on whether we were able to show at trial whether we...
But have you raised any constitutional issue about...
Not by our motion to dismiss, sir. I think a constitutional...
And you haven't pressed any constitutional issue here?
No, sir, except for the fact that I do believe that there is a question of adequacy and effectiveness of the statutory remedy, which could invoke a constitutional question and which would require development of or litigation of an issue of fact in the trial court. The preclusion section, as I indicated, says there's to be no judicial review in enforcement proceedings of regulations which could be reviewed under the statutory review procedure. The review procedure is not now available to my client and could have been initiated only by filing a petition for review within 30 days of the date on which the regulation was issued. The Court of Appeals, in our view, ignored the language of Section 112C itself, which prohibits violation of an emission standard and which does not prohibit a violation of any regulation which the administrator might issue concerning asbestos. From that perspective, we're not prepared to concede that the trial court was even reviewing the regulation within the meaning of the preclusive provision, as opposed to simply looking at the face of the regulation to ascertain whether it was, in fact, the type of regulation specified in the criminal prohibition. However, if that should be considered judicial review, we believe that it is review which is within the sphere of this court's decisions, which permit a limited type of review, even in circumstances when review of agency action is ordinarily unavailable. We trace that starting with this court's decision in Leadham versus Kine, in which this court indicated that statutory review provisions normally contemplate review of agency action, which is at least on its face within the scope of agency authority, and therefore permitted an inquiry into the question of whether the agency in that case had complied with specific statutory instructions. Subsequently, in a case cited by the government in its brief, Brotherhood of Railway Clerks versus Non-Contract Employees, this court again said that non-statutory review is available to assure that agency action does not exceed the statutory authority, and that action which is ordinarily non-reviewable is in fact reviewable to the extent of ascertaining that the agency performed its statutory duty. And in the Brotherhood of Railway Clerks case, this court, as I read the decision, entered holdings on the merits on those limited issues of whether the agency action was within the scope of its authority and whether it, at least on its face, purported to comply with the agency's statutory duty. Those holdings were not jurisdictional, as I read them. They were holdings on the merits. Last year, in the Thermtron Products case, concerning the removal procedures from federal to state, from state to federal courts, rather, and the remand procedures back, this court held that the statutory preclusion of review of a remand order, which on its face purported to be absolute, still permitted judicial review in the limited sense of ascertaining whether a trial court order of remand was at least based upon one of the grounds for remand specified in the statute. This past June, the two Voting Act cases, which are cited in the government's brief, I believe continue to recognize this principle of the availability of limited review. In Briscoe versus Bell, the court avoided holding that coverage determinations by the Attorney General and by the Director of Census were not open to judicial inquiry, at least to ascertain whether there was reliance by those officials upon the criteria specified in the statute for making those determinations. And on the same day, in Morris versus Grissett, the majority opinion of this court noted that Congress, like the courts, operates on the assumption that public officials will perform their duty, and indicates that line of inquiry harkens back to Leadham versus Kine and to Railway Clerks, which indicates to me a line of authority of this court which is very sound, in my view, and very persuasive, that legislation governing the scope of review of agency action simply does not contemplate agency action which is lawless. That even where the review provisions say review is unavailable, there can be at least an inquiry to ascertain whether an agency took action which on its face complied with what a statute told the agency to do.
Of course, this statute didn't say review was unavailable. It said it just had to be taken within a certain time, didn't it?
Well, in our position now, it's unavailable.
Well, I suppose you can say that about the statute of limitations or latches, too. If you let them go long enough, it's unavailable. But that doesn't mean that the statute of limitations is ignored.
No, I don't think there's really, from the in the context of this case,
isn't Chairman.
Your Honor, I don't think there's really a difference. Between saying you can't review it unless you seek review within 30 days of the time when it's issued, or saying you can't review it at all. I think the question still is, if Congress passes a law which says you must seek review within 30 days or not at all, do they contemplate by the term review or by that provision, do they contemplate foreclosing the federal judiciary from any jurisdiction to inquire into the question of whether an administrative agency has committed an act which on its face is unlawful?
Even though the attack on the administrative action come 2 or 3 years after the promulgation of the regulation?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think that limited inquiry is always open. I think it's always open for us to say that we're being prosecuted for conduct which Congress did not make a crime. Congress said you can't violate an emission standard, and if we can't raise the question of whether or not this regulation is an emission standard, I think we're in the position of having a Sixth Circuit decision stand which holds that we can be brought to trial and convicted for conduct which Congress did not make a crime. I think we're in the position, if the Sixth Circuit's decision stands, I think we're in the position of having a rule which says that even though this agency was at the time in violation of its own continuing mandatory duty to promulgate the kind of regulation Congress told them to promulgate, an emission standard, nonetheless, the federal courts are going to enforce that violation of law by the agency. And they're going to do it by convicting my client of conduct which was not made a crime by Congress. We think that's wrong. And I don't think it matters whether our attack upon the agency's action as being lawless on its face comes 2 years or 20 years after the regulation is promulgated.
Did the agency think this was an emission standard?
The agency gave it the title of emission standard. I think the agency's position has not been entirely consistent as to whether it is or is not an emission standard, and I'm not certain that the agency has ever really squarely addressed that particular question. I think the agency has, as I understand them...
Well, you didn't give it too much of a chance, did you? I mean, you could have gone to the agency.
We have gone to the agency in other proceedings, sir, which
yes,
are
but not this one.
Not this one, no, sir.
And, well, another in other proceedings, has the agency said it was an admission standard?
No, sir. The agency has always taken the position that we are questioning the validity of the regulation, that we're questioning its authority to issue the regulation, and that the regulation is authorized. I don't think they have ever, to my knowledge, focused on the question simply of whether or not it's an emission standard.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.
Counsel, we'll ask you to yield while a motion for admission is made because some sponsors failed to show this morning.
Mr. Irwin and Griswold.
Mr. Griswold.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of James E. Dow, Jr. and of Ronald T. Mitchell, both of the Virgin Islands. I am satisfied that they possess the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Dow and Mr. Mitchell will be admitted. The clerk will administer the oath, but before he does that, let me extend to each one of you on behalf of the court a warm welcome as members of the bar of the court and officers of the court.
You solemnly swear that as attorney and as counsel of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly before the law, that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God.
You may proceed, Mr.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. before the luncheon break, if I recall, I was asked whether the agency had ever itself considered the question of whether the work practice rule is an emission standard, and I think I'd like to expand upon my answer just briefly, if I may. I think the agency has always known the work practice rule is not an emission standard. On December 7, 1971, when it first published its proposed regulations in the Federal Register, the following statement appears in the preamble to the proposed regulations at volume 36, page 23239 of the Federal Register, quote, "Because there is no suitable technique for sampling and analyzing asbestos in the ambient air or in emission gases, the standards are expressed as requirements for the operation of specific control equipment or other equipment of comparable effectiveness, or in situations where no control system is available, as prohibitions on the use of asbestos. When acceptable source sampling and analytical methods are available, and it is possible to delineate hazardous levels, these standards may be revised to require compliance with a measured allowable emission." On April 6, 1973, when the work practice regulation was first promulgated in final form, in the preamble to that publication at volume 38, page 8820 of the Federal Register, the agency stated, quote, "It is not practicable at this time to establish allowable numerical concentrations or mass emission limits for asbestos." And then in the third column of the same page, quote, "The means of control used are limitations on visible emissions with an option in some cases to use designated control equipment, requirements that certain procedures be followed, and prohibitions on the use of certain materials or of certain operations. These means of control are required because of the impossibility at this time of prescribing and enforcing allowable numerical concentrations or mass emission limitations known to provide an ample margin of safety."
Does that appear in anything you've filed here, what you've just read?
I'm certain that the final publication is cited in the brief. I'm also certain that the quotation is not, sir.
The quotation is not there, the but the citation
I'm certain that the Federal Register publication of this is the final regulation, as published. I think the only other thing I need to say, if the Court please, is that the only inquiry which is necessary here to ascertain that the Administrator did not comply with Section 112B of the Act is whether or not the regulation on its face is an emission standard. And the result of that inquiry shows that my client is indeed being prosecuted for something Congress did not make criminal. And we believe that that is simply wrong and that it should be reversed. The portion of the Federal Register at which the final regulation is promulgated, Mr. Chief Justice, is cited at page 5 of our brief, and the regulation itself is quoted. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Easterbrook.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the central statutory provision at issue here is Section 307B of the Clean Air Act Amendments. That section provides that the District of Columbia Circuit has exclusive jurisdiction to any challenge of the action of the Administrator of the EPA in promulgating any emission standard, and that review may be had in that court on any petition filed within 30 days of the promulgation, or thereafter, if new grounds arise after the 30th day. Section 307B2 provides, and I quote, "Action of the administrator with respect to which review could have been obtained under the first paragraph shall not be subject to judicial review in civil or criminal proceedings for enforcement. That statute is abundantly clear. The challenge petitioner now raises to the validity of the emission standard promulgated by the administrator.
Just so I've got it clear, is there any restriction on what issues could be raised in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia?
There is none, Your Honor. The District of
Whether you've gone to the administrator with them or not?
Well, the District of Columbia Circuit requires that the claims have been raised. Statutory claim.
So that if you haven't presented a particular claim to the agency, the court won't hear it?
There are sometimes problems of exhaustion of administrative remedies, Your Honor, that would go with claims of this sort. If it were a claim being raised for the first time in the District of Columbia Circuit that the administrator had never had a chance to consider, it might be appropriate not to consider it, or it might be appropriate under District of Columbia Circuit
practice. What would you think about a coverage question?
Just say that
the regulation just simply isn't authorized by the statute.
I think that
must have been presented to the administrator before the court will hear it?
No, Your Honor. I think the pure coverage case could be raised at any time in the D.C. Not at any time, but it could be raised in the D.C. Circuit.
And without ever having been presented to the administrator?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about a constitutional challenge to the underlying statute?
The result of that would be the same, since the administrator lacks the authority to declare the underlying statute unconstitutional.
And what about the constitutionality of a regulation?
I think that would depend in part on the nature of the challenge to the regulation. If the nature of the challenge were such that a regulation easily could have been drafted consistent with the protestant's view of constitutionality, that kind of claim should be presented first to the administrator so that he would have a chance to draft a regulation that, in the view of the challenger, is constitutional. If there were a constitutional claim in this case, that rationale would not apply because the administrator has already considered whether it is practicable to promulgate a regulation in some other form, and we have the administrator's judgment on that. There would be no point in asking for his judgment again.
How do you work all that into the 30-day time limit? The administrative exhaustion.
The 30-day time limit commences to run, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, only after the final promulgation of the regulation. These regulations are promulgated after notice and comment rulemaking. In this case, the initial notice and publication came in 1971, and there was a process of more than a year before the final promulgation. The 30 days commence to run only after the final promulgation of the regulation.
Okay, well, supposing the person in question gets a copy of the notice or advice of it, doesn't do anything then, and the regulation becomes final, and then he seeks to challenge it in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit within 30 days. Is he then barred because he didn't challenge it before the agency?
If he not only did not challenge it before the agency, but no one challenged it before the agency on those grounds, then consistent with the rationale that I gave in answer to Mr. Justice White's question, I think he would then be barred in the D.C. Circuit. The statute itself, as I have said, is quite clear, and the contention that petitioner now raises is one that he could have raised in the District of Columbia Circuit under the answer that I gave to Mr. Justice White. Indeed, petitioner conceded in the district court, a concession that appears at page 85 of the Court of Appeals appendix, that he could have raised in the District of Columbia Circuit the contentions he now raises. Because the challenge could have been raised in that court.
Mr. Easterbrook, may I stop you there? Could he have raised it on the theory that it was an emission standard under Section 112 within the meaning of 307B1?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand
your
question.
The plain language of the statute controls. B2 says that you're barred unless you file the petition for review as authorized by B1. B1 authorized the petition for review of the action of the administrator in promulgating any admission standard. So for us to conclude that he should have followed that procedure, need we not decide that it was an emission standard?
I believe not, Your Honor, and I can answer that in several respects. That Section B2 says that review is barred on any question that could have been reviewed under B1.
Correct.
So in order for petitioner to prevail here, you would have to first conclude that his contentions are ones that the District of Columbia Circuit could not have considered on a petition being filed under B1.
Correct.
The District of Columbia Circuit has held in the Ohato case, which is cited in the footnote at page 15 of our brief, that it may consider challenges similar to the challenge at issue here, that is, contention that the regulation was, on its face, not the kind of thing that the statute authorized. Under that rationale, this was a challenge, review of which could have been had in the D.C. Circuit, and of which review, therefore, may not be had now under B-2. I can set out a couple of reasons for that. The argument that you can now review in a criminal proceeding the contention that there is no emission standard would essentially make the question of jurisdiction turn on the merits. That is, under petitioner's view, review would be precluded only after the district court had already given the regulation full review.
Yes, but under your view, if the administrator promulgates something called an emission standard, and the text of it is that every wrecker shall pay $500 a month into a conservation fund, he's bound to go to the Court of Appeals, no matter how far away from the legislative intent that was.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I don't think that we need to make an argument that extreme in order to prevail here. Let me suggest the two kinds of inquiry that I think a district court should ask. The first kind of inquiry is whether the administrator's regulation purports to rely on Section 112, that is, whether he says that this is an emission standard. Second kind of question the district court might ask, and properly so, is whether the administrator's regulation purports to control the emission of the hazardous substance, since Section 112 is a section dealing with release of hazardous substances into the air. The district court, if it answers those questions affirmatively, that is, if it says the administrator says he's relied on Section 112, and this regulation in fact controls the emission of hazardous substances into the air, should conclude its inquiry at that point. There are, of course, a myriad of ways in which the administrator might go about controlling those kinds of emissions. The question whether he has controlled emissions in the very way that the statute contemplated is, we think, exactly the kind of question Congress had in mind when it required review of that thing to come in the District of Columbia Circuit.
But even if the district court asks those questions and answers them, no, this isn't the kind of a he doesn't even purport to be acting under this section. That question still could have been raised in the Court of Appeals under your argument.
When I answered Mr. Justice Rehnquist by saying that we did not have to go as far as his hypothetical, I did not mean to say that we think it would be inappropriate for the District of Columbia Circuit to review it. I mean, ultimately,
well, there are then some questions that can be raised later despite Section 2.
I think, no, the suggestion that I made to Mr. Justice Rehnquist was, I think, the same kind of question that the District of Columbia Circuit would ask itself when someone filed a petition for review in the District of Columbia Circuit. That is to say, before that court could exercise its statutory review authority, it would have to decide whether the claim that was being made before it was a challenge to something under Section 112. Pardon?
If it's wrong enough, we won't review it.
Not if it's wrong enough, but if it's not, not even purported to be promulgated under this section.
So we'll just let it stand.
The District of Columbia Circuit's answer, I think, would be that this would be something for an original action in the district court. Similar problems were before this court last year in the three DuPont cases, involving the question whether the Court of Appeals or the district court would have review of certain regulations promulgated by the administrator. Before you could decide that question, you had to decide what kind of regulations they were. I think the District of Columbia Circuit must ask the same kind of question when someone files a petition for review with it. It says, this is a regulation promulgated by the administrator. Is it the kind of thing described in Section 307B1? If so, it will review it there. If not, it must dismiss the petition for review. And the two criteria that I gave in answer to Mr. Justice Rehnquist are, I believe, the criteria that that court should ask. I think if you ask those questions here, the regulation satisfies those criteria and therefore was one that could have been reviewed in the District of Columbia Circuit. Let me go back, if I can, briefly to discuss the legislative history of Section 307B, because I believe it sheds considerable light on the kinds of things that must be reviewed in the District of Columbia Circuit. Section 307B originated in the Senate, which adopted the limitation on judicial review as an alternative, according to the Senate report at page 41, to an absolute preclusion. The reason why it was considering something as extreme as an absolute preclusion of judicial review was that it wanted, and I quote, to maintain the integrity of the time sequences provided throughout the Act. Each of the steps in promulgation of regulations and review of regulations is a precondition to something else, in this case a precondition to compliance. But one of the necessities of compliance is to have a valid regulation. And so Congress centralized review in a single forum, the District of Columbia Circuit, with a very short time limitation for review in order to achieve two important objectives. The first of those objectives was to make sure that any review would produce uniform results across the nation. All competitors in the industry would be subjected to the same standards rather than different standards that might be imposed by different judges. And second, it wanted to be sure that if, in fact, the regulation was invalid, the invalidity would be detected quickly so that the administrator could then promulgate a new and valid regulation. That required a time limitation on judicial review. Congress set out to give the regulations, after the period for review had expired, the same unquestioned authority as the statute itself. Section 307 accomplished that end, and the position of petitioner, which amounts to saying that the regulations are always open to challenge, would frustrate that end. We understand petitioner to make three kinds of arguments. First, petitioner argues that any regulation may be attacked on its face at any time. Second, and this is a variation of the first argument that I have already discussed in part, petitioner contends that Section 307B applies only to regulations that are, in fact and in law, emission standards. The third contention, which petitioner makes only implicitly but which the district court made more clearly, is that Section 307 applies only to attacks on the procedure by which the regulation was promulgated and not to contentions that the substance of the regulation is unauthorized by statute. None of these arguments is correct, and I will take them up in turn. The first argument, that regulations may be attacked on their face at any time, is inconsistent with the progeny of the Yakis case. In the wake of Yakis, which upheld against constitutional attack a statute very similar to Section 307B, this Court applied that rule of preclusion in a number of cases attacking regulations as inconsistent on their face with the statute authorizing the promulgation of price regulations. These cases are collected at page 24 of our brief. If there were any reason to distinguish between attacks on the face of the regulation and attacks on the regulation as applied, and Section 307 makes no such distinction, it would be more appropriate to bar facial attacks. After all, facial defects are known the instant a regulation is promulgated, whereas attacks on the regulation as applied in particular cases may not come to rise until later, and therefore it may be difficult to protest within 30 days things that are unknown at the time of the promulgation. Petitioner contends, however, that Leadham against Kine supports the position that a person always may challenge a regulation as facially inconsistent with the authorizing statute. But this Court has pointed out in later cases, most recently last June in Briscoe against Bell, footnote 13, that Leadham did not establish that principle. Leadham was a case in which judicial review was conditioned on a final order by the National Labor Relations Board. It was necessary to construe that ambiguous term in order to determine when review was appropriate. If in Leadham that term had not been construed to make review available, it might never have been available. But those problems don't arise here.
Well, didn't Leadham involve a certification of a bargaining unit?
Of a bargaining unit.
And isn't review always available on an A5 violation for refusal to bargain?
It would be available only if the employer then refused to bargain.
Right, and that's the normal way in which it's reviewable. It's reviewable thousands of times a year by the board, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But in Leadham, the question was inclusion of particular employees in the bargaining unit.
Right.
And the employer and the employee the employer and the union were then going to bargain, there never would have been any 8A5 violation in Leadham. The 8A5 violation can come about only if the employer refuses to bargain.
To bargain, and he can refuse to bargain because he says this is not the appropriate bargaining unit.
But that wasn't going to happen in Leadham.
It didn't happen because Leadham said that an appeal was allowable before it happened.
But my point, Mr. Justice Stewart, was that there was going to be no review in Leadham because the employer had already said that he was willing to bargain. So it was a case in which there could be no effective review at all. And that was the need to resolve the ambiguity. Later cases, such as Brotherhood of Railway Trainmen, have construed Leadham rather narrowly. And in any event, Leadham did not involve a review preclusion statute like Section 307, nor did it involve what 307 involves. It's not a complete preclusion of review. It's a statute requiring contentions to be made in a particular court at a particular time. It does not bar Adamo from challenging the regulation.
Well, if there's any practical, you mentioned the word practical a couple sentences ago. And if you take a wrecker out in 2,000 miles away from Washington that doesn't read the Federal Register and so forth, has a very small business, this kind of a statute really practically bars him from challenging it, doesn't it?
I don't think that's so, Your Honor. There are a number of means that small contractors have to address these kinds of problems. One is to form a trade association, which the National Association of Demolition Contractors is, which acts effectively as the agent of all of the small demolition contractors for reading the Federal Register and advising them of their interests. And in some cases, including a subsequent challenge to the regulations at issue here, the National Association of Demolition Contractors has filed a petition for judicial review, acting to protect the interests of its members. That kind of collective action is always available to small contractors. But the second answer is that I think that it's appropriate for Congress to require small contractors to read the Federal Register. When contractors are dealing, as they are here, with a material like asbestos, which is one of the most potent cancer-causing agents known, it's not unreasonable for Congress to pass a statute which tells those who may cause the deaths of innocent people to read the Federal Register.
Well, I may agree with that, and perhaps all the court may agree with that, but I think you should delete the word practical, then, from your argument, because as a practical matter, many, many small businessmen would be precluded from reviewing this sort of thing.
I didn't want to imply that all of them would read the Federal Register, and I retract that kind of suggestion. Second argument, which we have discussed briefly already, is that Section 307 applies only to emission standards, and that therefore you have to decide first whether something is an emission standard in order to know whether review is precluded in the district court. I think the answer to that, as I said to you earlier, Mr. Justice Stevens, is that that makes jurisdiction turn on the merits, and it makes it turn on the merits in a way that would make Section 307B completely ineffective. One of the things that can be done to challenge regulations of this sort is to contend that they are not only not emission standards, but they're not emission standards because they're arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion and the like. It's clear that Congress did not authorize the administrator of the EPA to be arbitrary or to be capricious or to abuse his discretion or to do something that on its face is unreasonable. All of those things are reasons why the administrator has acted unlawfully and therefore has not promulgated the kind of emission standard that the statute contemplated. But if those kinds of contentions are open, then Section 307B means nothing, because those are surely at the core of what Congress intended to preclude. As I think are contentions that rather than regulating emissions of asbestos in one way by requiring it to be wetted, it should have regulated emissions of asbestos in some other way, that is, by setting numerical standards. All of those attacks on how the administrator ought to go about the business of regulating asbestos emission are the kinds of things that Congress intended to be reviewed in the District of Columbia Circuit, and that therefore cannot be reviewed now.
But, Mr. Easterbrook, there's a rather clear difference between what the statute says in the category you describe, arbitrary and capricious and the like. It's quite clear that the statute purports to preclude review because you are dealing with an emission standard, albeit one that's arbitrary or erroneous. But if your question is whether or not it is an emission standard, the statute, it's true that you have to decide the merits to decide the jurisdictional issue, but I'm not sure that's an answer.
In part, I think we may have become engaged in a semantic exercise. My point, and perhaps an excessively semantic one, was that it's always possible to say that because the regulation was arbitrary and capricious, it was not the kind of emission standard that Congress contemplated at all. Ultimately, what petitioner is arguing is that what the administrator did is not the kind of emission standard that Congress contemplated. Petitioner agrees, I believe, that Congress intended the administrator to regulate asbestos and to control the amount of asbestos that could come off into the air. What this dispute is about is how best the administrator should do that and whether Congress authorized him to do it in a particular way. And although you can, it is true, always phrase that as a question as to whether there is any emission standard at all, it is equally reasonable to phrase it as the question whether the emission standard that the administrator promulgated was the kind of thing that Congress had in mind.
Would any of your arguments be any different, Mr. Easterbrook, if the time period was 10 days?
Those kinds of arguments would go, Mr. Chief Justice, to whether the procedures for review established an adequate forum in which it could be reviewed. We understand petitioner's answer to Mr. Justice White. He is not contending that the opportunity for review was in fact inadequate. Petitioner has said that he is going to reserve these for disposition at the trial. We believe that they cannot be so reserved under Rule 12B of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. But in any event, petitioner is not making any argument that the opportunity for review in the District of Columbia Circuit was inadequate. And I think the 10-day review would pose more difficult questions. But I think I ought to point out that Congress has been sensitive to these kinds of concerns. The most recent legislation, which the President signed in August and which we refer to in the first footnote of our supplemental brief, extends from 30 to 60 days the time within which to challenge the provision in the District of Columbia Circuit, so that Congress has been very careful not to cut off necessary opportunities to receive and study the regulation before deciding whether to object.
Do you know any other federal statute that has a 30-day limitation?
Your Honor, there are a number of such statutes which are collected in one of the footnotes to our brief, the Federal Trade Commission and the Securities and Exchange Commission statutes contain 30-day limitations. And in both of those cases, violation of the rules can be criminal, can be lead to a criminal prosecution.
Is there still a 10-day limit on criminal appeals?
Yes, there is, I believe, Your Honor.
Of course, everyone in a criminal case is quite aware of all the conditions at the time the 10 days begins to run.
10 days would sometimes get exceedingly close in light of the possibility of mail delays or perhaps negligence in delivering the mail, the subject of an earlier case.
Mr. Easterbrook, assume for the moment that the statute, in addition to authorizing the administrator to promulgate emission standards, contained an exception, the substance of which read quite explicitly, that the administrator would have no authority to promulgate work rules. And let's assume further that the administrator went ahead and promulgated what fairly could be characterized as a work rule. Assume further there'd been no appeal within the 30-day period. Would that present a different case?
No, Your Honor, it would not. It would be the position of the United States that that complaint should be raised within 30 days in the District of Columbia Circuit. The question, one, again, of national applicability and one that ought to be resolved very quickly, is whether this is or is not the kind of thing that Congress forbade.
Even though it's perfectly clear that the administrator had violated the act of Congress?
I believe so, Your Honor. That should be resolved in the D.C. Circuit. The final ground for challenging, for arguing that there's jurisdiction in the district court, was one raised by the district court itself, which is that Section 307B1 refers only to the action of the administrator, quote, in promulgating, close quote, an emission standard. The district court thought that this meant that it referred only to procedural flaws and not to substantive flaws. The answer to that, of course, is that if 307b1 is interpreted in that way, the evident desire of Congress is again defeated because it's impossible to have unified and prompt review of the substantive rules. Indeed, if the district court were correct, the District of Columbia Circuit would have absolutely no authority to review the substantive portions of the objection. But the District of Columbia Circuit has held that it does have such authority, and we think rightly so. Petitioner's ultimate argument is simply that it is unfair to foreclose its attack on the regulations. We do not see the unfairness of which petitioner protests. Public regulatory offenses, of which this is one, are often strict liability offenses. That is, criminal sanctions can be imposed without any form of mens rea. The statute at issue here does not make violation of the regulations a strict liability offense. Emission in violation of a regulation is criminal only if done knowingly. But what it does require is that persons read the Federal Register at their peril or obtain someone else to do that for them. It is a standard,
I would think. Read it. You mean fail to read it and fail to have it available.
Find out what is going on in Washington that might affect their interests and take care of them.
Quite a large undertaking, don't you agree?
It's a large undertaking, and that, I think, is one of the reasons for the formation of the National Association of Demolition Contractors. But my point is that it's not unfair for Congress to require members of the industry to undertake that kind of project, to understand and to protect their own interests within a period of time. Petitioner, or someone acting in its behalf, had 30 days within which to file a petition for review. And the statute does provide that if any reasons arise later that would be good grounds for review, they may be raised later. The statute is simply a plan that allocates judicial review to a particular court at a particular time, and we believe that it should be respected. I'd like to make one final point in answer to Mr. Justice Brennan's first question of Mr. Lipnick. The case is still a live one, Mr. Justice Brennan, even though the statute has been amended, because the acts at issue here took place before the amendment. This is a criminal enforcement proceeding, and the ex post facto clause would prohibit the application of the 1977 amendments to this case, assuming that the 1977 amendments changed the law. It's our position that they did not change the law, and the legislative history of those amendments indicate that Congress was simply clarifying authority the administrator already possessed. But if, in fact, petitioner is right that the 1970 statute did not authorize this regulation, this criminal prosecution would not be assisted by the 1977 amendments.
Well, you say that it didn't change the law when it says that the words, the statute now, not the legislative history, the August 1977 statute, talks about when it not being feasible to prescribe an emission standard, the administrator may instead promulgate work practice standard. That sounds like they're two different animals, doesn't it?
It does, Mr. Justice Stewart. We have addressed that problem in footnote two pages over.
Well, yes, I know, but
referring to the legislative history. We think it's clear from the legislative history that the reason Congress addressed them as two different animals in the statute was to restrict the administrator's authority to use work practices instead of numerical limitations.
Well, it says, I've left some language out, as you know, design, equipment, work practice, or operational standard. But what we're involved with here is a work practice standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not very exclusive.
It is not, but I think that what Congress had in mind by giving them different names was to prefer one over the other.
Certainly indicates they're different things if you have to call them by different names, doesn't it?
If you want to say that the administrator must prefer numerical limits to work practice limitations, then I think you have to call them by different names. But the requirement that the administrator prefer one to the other is a new requirement that we think was not present in the 1970 statute. Thank you very much.
May I ask just one question about the new statute that I don't, it may be clear from the text, but I'm not sure. Did Congress also amend 307B at the same time to make it clear that review of the work practice rule would be in the Court of Appeals?
It did not amend that in 307B. It still refers, 307B1 still refers to
emissions,
things emission standards promulgated by Section 112.
Thank you.
Where do you now review work product, work practice standards?
They are treated as emission standards promulgated under Section 112 and reviewed in the District of Columbia Circuit.
By what authority? Yes.
Under Section 307B1. That?
Well, that's the most circular thing I ever heard of.
The statute is not a model of legislative draftsmanship, Mr. Justice Rehnquist.
We've discovered that. Mr. Lipnick.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I have only a few brief observations. First, the National Association of Demolition Contractors, which suddenly seems to have backed in as a party to this case, was in fact first organized within a very few months previous to the promulgation of the work practice regulation. It is true that the National Association of Demolition Contractors now undertakes certain legal activities which might be described as done jointly for its members. It is also true that that legal work was undertaken in response to the very problem which underlies this very case, which is that small businessmen do not read 10 and 20,000 pages of fine print of the Federal Register every year, and they particularly don't do it in 30 days, and I'm not aware of any act of Congress which says that they have to do so. I think a reference was made to the notice provision of the, to the notice proceeding of the administrator from the standpoint of publishing a proposed regulation for comment. I'm not sure that my client, Adamo Wrecking Company, knew about the proposed regulation either. I'm not sure that any wrecking company knew about it. I am sure that anybody picking it up to read it would find on the very first page, 23239 of volume 36 of the Federal Register, quote, "The sources covered in the asbestos standard are mining, milling, spraying, and manufacturing," period, close quote. I think it
Could I ask you, in the criminal enforcement proceeding, is there some, what is the state of knowledge by the defendant supposed to be for liability?
You mean as a matter of law?
Yeah.
As a matter of law, sir, I believe under the Boyce Motor Lines case, we have to be shown to have knowledge of the facts which would constitute a violation of the law. I take that to mean we have to know that the material that we are dealing with is in fact friable asbestos as defined in the regulation, and that we must also know that whatever it is we are proved to have done would in fact cause an emission of that material.
But it isn't required that you know anything about the law.
I believe that this Court's decisions in Boyce Motor Lines and its progeny make it very clear that our knowledge of the law is absolutely irrelevant.
I just wondered if under this statute it imposes any different standard.
Not that I'm aware of. I think the word is just knowingly, and I think that's the meaning of that term is well settled. I think that it's obvious on the face of the statute that Congress did not tell the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, just go out and do whatever you think is best to control emissions of asbestos. Congress, for whatever reason, and as the 1977 amendments teach us, Congress changed its mind and was persuaded that it should have done something differently in the first place. Congress originally told the administrator to go out and promulgate an emission standard. I think even before the 1977 amendments, there is no way that this act can be read as a whole, and particularly the references in other sections of the act to emission standards. There is just no way that one can conclude that it's reasonable to think that an emission standard is now or ever could have been the same thing as a work practice rule. They must be different things.
What if Congress had passed a law that simply said anything labeled an emission standard by the administrator and not challenged within 30 days of its promulgation shall be deemed written into the statute itself? Would you have any case?
I think
Well, the closest case I would have would be Thermtron from last year, in which, if I recall correctly, the statute said a decision remanding to a state court was absolutely unreviewable, and this court said that it was at least reviewable to ascertain that the trial judge had remanded on a ground specified as a basis for remand in the statute. I think if we can have that much inquiry here, we can look to see whether this regulation is in fact an emission standard. That's what we're charged with violating, an emission standard. There's no section of this act which says, or at least we're not, there is a section of this act, 113, if I recall correctly, which says that it's a crime to knowingly violate any regulation issued as part of a state implementation plan under Section 110. It is a crime to violate any regulation issued under Section 110 as part of a state implementation plan. The section we're charged with violating does not say it's a crime to violate any regulation the administrator might issue. It only says it's a crime to violate an emission standard. And if we can have the same scope of review as was accorded in the Hermannsdorfer case last year, I think that is enough to allow us to show that this regulation is not an emission standard, if indeed we're asking for review of the regulation. In our view, we still think that there is a substantial question whether we're asking for a ruling by the trial court on whether this indictment alleges an essential element of the crime.
Mr. Lipnick, if we should be persuaded that the jurisdictional issue depends on whether or not it's an emission standard, in other words, you have to decide the merits to decide whether 307b2 applies. In your view, should this court decide that question, or should we send it back to the Court of Appeals? Because the Court of Appeals did not decide that question, as I remember.
In our view, sir, I think the record is perfectly adequate to enable this court to decide it, particularly with the 1977 amendments, which I think make abundantly clear that a work practice rule just is not the same thing as an emission standard. And with the government just today said that in the government's view, the 1977 amendments don't change the law. I think that even without those facts, I think it's so clear on the face of the statute that this court can decide the question in the interest of judicial economy. But with the addition of the 77 amendments and with the government's position that 77 amendments don't change anything, I think that if this court should conclude that there is jurisdiction, I don't see how there's any room for doubt as to the result. And I think that if I recall correctly, in the Perkins case, which is cited in the government's brief, this court indicated that where the record was adequate to enable this court to decide a question which had not been decided by the Court of Appeals, that it would do so in the interest of judicial economy. And I would suggest that would be appropriate in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.